You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Now, today's podcast is an exploration into the loss of taste and smell in COVID-19 sufferers and how this relates to people's experience of food now, but also in the future. Joining us to discuss this is the fantastic Professor Barry Smith from the Institute of Advanced Studies, University of London. Barry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, a pleasure to join you, Stefan.
Now, you are, I believe, the UK lead for the Global Consortium for Chemosensory Research, and you're doing a study on the impact of loss of sense and taste in COVID-19 sufferers. Before we start delving into that, just tell us a little bit about your background and your role in the study.
Well, I am someone who has studied taste and smell, and working with psychologists and neuroscientists, we've been very interested in multisensory perception of flavor. So that's something I know that you and your listeners are very interested in. Mm. So you can't be interested in how we get our flavor experiences without paying a lot of attention to the sense of smell. We know how terribly important that is to constituting those meaty, fruity flavors that just disappear if you're reduced to what the tongue gives you, which is salt, sweet, sour, bitter, savory. So the smell research community is actually rather small. I mean, if you compare it to people in neuroscience working on vision, which is huge, smell is this tiny corner, and it hasn't always had very much attention. And then imagine the surprise when sometime in February and March, we started to hear lots of reports of people suddenly losing their sense of smell and taste. And this was being reported as the COVID outbreak was happening, and the reports of smell loss were tracking the disease. So we heard reports coming out of China, then Iran, that moved to Italy, Germany, France, the UK, the US. And what we noticed was something very different and unusual, and that is that people were reporting a sudden loss of smell, and it was often without any nasal blockages. I mean, people know if they have a cold or a flu, they often feel very bunged up, and they say, well, I can't smell very much. And unfortunately, some of them with a flu virus will go on to develop post-viral infection and repeated loss of smell. However, this was the sudden loss of smell. No other signs. And what we now know is that loss of taste and smell were the earliest and the most prevalent symptoms of COVID-19, and that very often people who were otherwise asymptomatic, they didn't know the virus, had developed this condition. And that's when chemosensory researchers around the world got together, started the GCCR, the Global Consortium of Chemosensory Research, 600 odd people from 40 countries. And I was the UK lead, and working with ear, nose and throat clinicians, working with smell loss patient groups, and working with sensory scientists, we were trying to campaign furiously with the government and with Public Health England to have loss of smell recognized as an official symptom. Because you remember, Stefan, that for a long time, people were reporting having a loss of smell. Even Matt Hancock was on one of the daily briefings of the political reporting of COVID-19, standing there with a scientific medical officer saying, well, I had loss of smell when I had COVID-19. And the deputy chief medical officer, the man of the metaphor, Jonathan Van Tam, said, not significant, not important. That's not something we should really pay any attention to. How wrong he was, because we reckon now about 65% of those who have COVID-19 suffered loss of smell, and sadly about 15% of them will continue with a loss of smell.
Okay, well, let's dive into this a little bit. Do we have any idea why this happens?
Science has ramped up considerably, and that's why, in a way, it's a very invigorating time for those of us who work on smell, because there's tremendous effort to find out what the mechanisms are. We don't know exactly, but this is what we know. We know the coronavirus binds to these cells, ACE2 cells, that they lock onto them, and that we've got ACE2 cells in the nose. Now, strangely enough, they're not in olfactory receptors. So there isn't a direct attack on your olfactory sensing system. But there are supporting cells in the olfactory epithelium in the nose and in the nasal cleft at the top of the nose. There are these supporting cells, sustentacular cells, and they are important to enable you to smell. And it's these ones that seem to get infected because that's where the ACE2 cells are. Now, a lot of people who had infection there, they have inflammation that blocks off the route to getting molecules to the receptors. So it's a sort of, it doesn't block your breathing, so you don't feel bunged up, but it does actually occlude the ability for the odors to reach those olfactory cells. Now, if people's inflammation died down, a lot of people will have in 2 weeks of pretty nasty symptoms of COVID-19, they often recover the sense of smell. But for those whose inflammation remained high and the body was still fighting, there would be these cytokine storms and you would get splashback. And that seemed to be damaging, sometimes destroying olfactory receptors. And that's where you saw longer term loss of smell. But the nose is a terribly important infection site. And, you know, I want to say this because we're not out of the woods yet as we're recording this podcast. That's why I'm a keen advocate of wearing masks. You know, given that I know the nose is a really dangerous infection site, given I know it leads you to a risk of loss of smell for the longer term, wear a mask, cover that nose.
Now, am I right in thinking that we still aren't entirely clear on the mechanism by which a flavor volatile will create the smell sensation, or do we? Is there now a consensus on how the mechanism works?
We know an awful lot about smell, but still a lot to learn. I mean, smell is still more mysterious than taste. We know what the basic tastes are. We know this salt, sweet, sour, bitter, umami. And we also know that there are dedicated receptors for those. In the case of smell, things are a little more complicated and still not entirely tractable. You've got broadly tuned receptors, olfactory receptors that will respond to many odors, and then you've got some others that are more specific that will respond to only some odors. But for every single odor molecule that can be detected, many receptors will identify that molecule or be required for identifying that molecule. And equally, for any of those receptors, they'll also participate in identifying other odor molecules, other smells. So there's no clear way of saying how the coding works.
Yeah.
But we know that without that sense of smell, you're not going to get fruit flavors, meaty flavors. Coffee will suddenly become what it really is without its aroma, which is hot water with a bitter taste. Yeah. So, you know, you need
my idea of hell.
Yeah, absolutely, my idea of hell.
And has this the research that you've been doing into the effects of COVID-19 helped with understanding the mechanism anymore, or are things still a little bit opaque?
Well, it's crucially important that we get very reliable information from sufferers and from patients. I mean, interestingly, lots of hypotheses come up about what the mechanism is, and that's where getting reports from patients who tell us what the course of their experience and loss and sometimes recovery is are clues to the mechanism. So one of the things that we know, this sudden loss of smell, and especially the fact that it was happening without a blocked nose, told us, you know, this isn't like a flu impact. It's slightly different. There's something here that's special and distinctive to COVID. Equally, the fact that we had people recovering after 14 days, the sense of smell's back. It didn't come back all at once. Quite often, colleagues of mine who had lost the sense of smell would say, "Oh, I can smell rosemary, but nothing else." Or and a day later, they'd say to me, "Oh, I can now smell mint, but I can't smell bleach if I'm cleaning kitchen surfaces."
That is amazing, isn't it?
Amazing. So there was this sort of slow recovery, bit by bit, it was coming back. And It's interesting for the rest of us to notice just how much we need to understand about smell, because, and this is the thing that I think we are learning now, is that many people lost the sense of smell, anosmia, as we've all learned to identify that. That
finally, condition. Everyone knows what the word is.
Yeah. Finally, you know, for those of us who've been talking about this forever and they're saying, hey, what? You know, now we know anosmia. Maybe even Jonathan Van Tam now knows anosmia. Yeah, and after our 8-week campaign against him to have it recognized as a symptom, but there we are. So we had anosmia, but here's the new thing, Stefan, which is now the focus of lots of my colleagues' research and that I'm involved in too. We're noticing that some people are recovering. The anosmia is gone. They have a period of a week or so, maybe a couple of weeks, where they say, oh, my sense of smell is back. It's fine. And then they start noticing distorted sense of smell. Mm-hmm. And this is called parosmia. Now, parosmia, we've known before, it's been seen in post-viral infections and actually seen in cases of people suffering from head injury too. So parosmia is where familiar things now smell very different, very distorted. And not only that, they smell quite disgusting.
Yeah. And this is different from phantosmia.
This is different from phantosmia. Phantosmia is where you have an experience of a smell, but there's no source. So suddenly, you know, you'll have this chemical smell or a smell of sort of cheesy smell, and you'll think, oh, what have I left out? Or smell of, you know, rotting garbage, and you look around and there's nothing there. So that's a hallucination, an olfactory hallucination. But parosmia is where familiar things are now experienced often in a very disgusting way. Let's go back to some of the familiar triggers for this. So coffee. A lot of people discover they're sufferers of parosmia when they have coffee, and it now is unbearable. It has that. The best description I've heard is it tastes like fruity sewage.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, my gosh! So there's a sort of sweetness and a disgustingness in there, and they can't bear it, and they can't bear the smell of it. Certainly can't bear to taste it. And what's interesting is that. You know, this is what leads us to new potential research avenues. Yeah. This leads us to think, you know, well, so there's a mystery. Why do people seem to regain their sense of smell and then develop parosmia? That's a mystery. But in the case of parosmia, let's go back to what I said at the beginning, that we know that many receptors are involved in binding to and identifying particular odor molecules, and those receptors are involved in identifying different smells, different odor molecules. What seems to be going on in parosmia is a kind of, as your receptors grow back, there's a faulty wiring. They've been kind of connected to the wrong ports, if you like. So you're getting faulty signals. Now, that was the original view of parosmia, and people thought, that's a pretty good understanding of it. However, some beautiful research coming out of a friend and collaborator of mine at the University of Reading, Jane Parker. Jane Parker has been, even before COVID, was looking at parosmia and discovering particular food groups. And there are particular chemical families that seem to be triggers, particular triggers for parosmia. Mm. Coffee is one. Roasted meats is another. So Maillard reaction, Maillard compounds that happen when we start to heat food and roast it and break down the proteins, and we get the cascade of chemical reactions that give us more and more of those lovely flavor aromas. That seems to be in there. Onions, garlic, they seem to be in there too. And so what Jane has done both before and during COVID, where she could, she takes people into the lab. They sit down in front of a GCO. So this is gas olfactometry. You're sitting with your nose in a little cone, and this chemical machine takes a substance like coffee or a piece of roasted meat, and it allows the volatile molecules to come off at different speeds and different rates. And so all of the things in that mixture, that's coffee or meat or onion, come at you separately. And she's been identifying, you know, which particular sulfur compounds are people suddenly finding unbearable, or are they noticing more? Now, mechanism, good question what that is. Two hypotheses. One hypothesis is that somehow those really disgusting things, which are in coffee, you know, sulfur compounds are in there. So our sulfur compounds are in the Maillard reaction of aromas and flavors too. Maybe they're being boosted. Maybe, you know, we're particularly sensitive to those. The other thought is maybe we just are losing some of the other molecules and aromas that mask those flavors, that dilute them and prevent us. So one thing is, you know, imagine if we have a lot of long-term parosmia sufferers, could we make coffee by muting or taking out or reducing some of these notes? Don't know, but that's maybe worth a try.
So this is where it becomes really fascinating, where this condition becomes an opportunity to research and understand not just smell, but also potentially the COVID-19 as well. And have you seen this? Is this a route to understanding the function of the virus itself? And is it a route to understanding a little bit more about smell and taste?
Certainly a route to understanding the virus, because this idea that it's persisting, that's persisting in the nose, or that the consequences of infection in the nose and in the ACE2 cells in the nose, that is leading to long-term damage. It makes it more likely, we think, that inflammation is one of the problems here. It's very interesting that inflammation had become a bit of a new topic in medicine even before COVID-19. People were noticing a link between inflammation and depression. People were, you know, when the body's organs are inflamed, eventually some of that inflammation spreads to the brain when it crosses the blood-brain barrier, and then you get tremendously depressed people, because, you know, you switch off, you close down, you try to cope with that inflammatory state. You know, we were discovering that irritable bowel syndrome, bad eating habits and distress to the cell walls of the stomach were meaning that the bacteria, which are so good in the gut, our microbiome, that some of them were leaking out. And while they were good when digesting food, they were very bad if they got into the bloodstream and if they crossed the blood-brain barrier.
So another system of the gut-brain axis, but actually another slightly system different.
Yeah. But a lot of this is coming from, as I say, coming from inflammation. Now, inflammation is interesting because it's a protective mechanism. It's something which, you know, when the body's being attacked, when there are things to defend against, then you get an inflammatory response. And with any, you know, our immune system does that when it's attacked by a virus. But if it overacts, if you get too much inflammation, it actually does more of the damage than the virus itself does. And that looks to be the case in olfaction with COVID-19. It's not the coronavirus itself that's doing the damage. It's some of the reactions to and consequences of that, the body's defenses that are probably creating the damage. So there we're learning a little bit about mechanism. But if we look at parosmia, that's still a mystery. I mean, we've had parosmia, we've had anosmia, but we haven't seen this new course of experience, which is suffering from anosmia, returning to normal, then developing parosmia. That's a mystery. Nobody's at all sure why that happens.
And we have to be aware that we're going to be left with, I mean, if you look at it on an epidemiological sort of scale, we are going to be left with a large section of the population with do you think that there's going to be an ongoing problem? And you were saying you gave a percentage for the amount of people who continued to have this problem.
Yes. So, you know, we know 70 million people have been infected with COVID-19. We know 65% of those roughly have had smell disorder. And then we think of those having smell disorder, 10 to 15% will have continued smell problems, either continued loss of smell or smell dysfunction, like parosmia, phantosmia. Mm-hmm. That's many millions of the population around the world.
So what can we do? Is there anything that we can do to help people who are suffering from anosmia?
I think there, well, for anosmia, we can do one or two things. What's been found is that smell training is one of the best things that people can try. Now, this is something that ear, nose, and throat clinicians know about, and most GPs and other medics don't know about. So smell training is quite extraordinary. What you do is you get four essential oils. The classic set that people had used was lemon, clove, eucalyptus, and rose. And you smell them first thing in the morning, last thing at night. And if you're suffering from anosmia, you will be sniffing, and you'll say, this is pointless because I'm not getting anything. But we tell people, do persevere, because there's evidence that people who do smell training, as opposed to a group who don't, there's a higher incidence of people regaining the sense of smell, recovering the sense of smell.
That's so extraordinary.
And I think what's happening is, even though there's no experience, everything seems muted and absent, trying to do the sniffing, you are actually encouraging the pathways to reconnect. You're trying to get the connection between those olfactory receptors in the nose, in the wet mucous membrane, connected up to the olfactory bulb and the piriform cortex. And from the piriform cortex and olfactory bulb back down, the neural signals are going in both directions. Mm. And by just the act of sniffing that stimulus, A, you know I'm sniffing something called rose. You've probably got a memory of what rose smells like. You know, you're really trying to drive the pathway into its usual route and connection and get everything back to normal. So smell training does seem to work. It's also, I'll tell you an interesting fact about smell training. As we get older, as we all are, our sense of smell start to decline, just as our eyesight does and our hearing does, our senses generally. But using smell training helps you keep your sense of smell longer and keep it more acute. But it doesn't just mean that you keep your sense of smell going. It also means that you're more cognitively active. So there's a lovely study done by Thomas Hummel's group in Dresden. It's one of the sort of leading centers for olfactory research. And what they did was they had 70-year-olds, and they had one group doing Sudoku for 3 months and the other group doing smell training for 3 months. And what happens is, after 3 months, the Sudoku people are better at doing Sudoku, but they're not really any more cognitively active on tests elsewhere. Mm. But the smell training group are better, more cognitively active elsewhere. So there you are. Smell training is better for you than Sudoku. So we should
that
all be doing
this. That is a beautiful thing. That's fantastic.
Isn't that fantastic? We should all be doing smell training. I mean, brilliant. I think the sense of smell is a use it or lose it sense. And you find, interestingly, again, it's just correlational, but you find that wine tasters, perfumers, people using the sense of smell seem to suffer less dementia than others. Mm-hmm. And I think, that again, there's a sort of interesting thing here. If you think of the elderly, what are they suffering from? Loss of memory and quite often depression. Now, we know loss of smell can lead to depression. Mm-hmm. We also know that you use your sense of smell to lay down memories of places. So your episodic memory about having gone to the bakery or knowing that you're by the sea or whatever, your sense of smell is involved in that. Now, when that goes, I think it's going to be very difficult to lay down new memories, and it's also going to leave you depressed. So I think for the aging population, we should get them all on smell training, and we should be making sure that they're remaining as active as possible. As I say, it's a use it or lose it sense. Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds like the phone is ringing at the Institute of Advanced Studies a little bit more recently, which is great news. So just finally, for anyone who has been suffering from loss of taste and smell and is not getting a particularly helpful response from maybe their GP or even possibly their family around them, what support is there for people?
So I would recommend that they look for Absent, and it's scent as in smell, absent.org or fifthsense.org.uk. These are both smell loss charities, and they have lots of information. And the best thing about both of these, and I work with both, best thing is that they have clinicians on board, they have ear, nose and throat surgeons, they have smell and taste experts and scientists working with them. So patients will get both a lot of information, but they'll also get, I think, the reassurance of reading about and hearing about and talking to others going through the same thing. I mean, I find on Twitter, again and again, people describe how distressed they are with food tasting different or smelling awful. And they didn't know what was going on, and nobody was really able to tell them. And then suddenly being able to say, you're not alone. A lot of people dealing with this, come and help us with our research. They say, oh, I'm so relieved to find other people who can give me reassurance that you know, they've got through it, or that they're undergoing this and that's what it's like. So there is information out there. It is supported now by some of the more informed medics, and the sensory scientists are working very closely with these patient groups. And so, yeah, there is help, and I hope people will reach out.
Fantastic. Okay, well, Barry, well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really look forward to finding out how all this unfolds. It feels as though it's going to shed light on a lot more things than just the experience of COVID-19 sufferers. So I really look forward to seeing how this unfolds in the future as well. There's been a lot of coverage of the potential of vitamins to help fight against COVID-19. Our immune system is our first line of defense when it comes to viruses. Is there a way that we can strengthen our own immunity to make us less susceptible to disease? Now, joining us to discuss this is Philip Calder, Professor of Nutritional Immunology, School of Human Development and Health, Faculty of Medicine at the University of Southampton. Good morning, Philip. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Now, last May, you led a review into the role of nutrition in immunity and host susceptibility to COVID-19. And that was updated in the autumn as well. And we talked to you about, I guess, about 8 months ago or so. Now, but before we go into the detail about the review and about what we've learned, could you just briefly talk us through the immune system? What do we mean by it? What does it do?
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. So the immune system is our defense system. It's how we defend ourselves, so cope with the presence of dangerous organisms, particularly microorganisms, by which I mean bacteria and viruses that we might encounter. So it's our way of identifying and dealing with those threats.
And has our understanding of the immune system changed significantly over the last few years?
Well, immunology is a wonderful science which is always progressing. So we know much more about the types of cells that are involved in our immune system and our immune defenses, how they work. There are many different subtleties amongst how those different cells are working, the chemical messages they produce, the way they communicate with one another. So we're always progressing in our understanding of immunity, that's for sure.
And when we talk about our adaptive immune system, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we have different branches of the immune system, if you like, and one of them is called the adaptive, sometimes it's called the acquired immune response. And what that word adaptive or acquired means is components of our immune system actually change according to the nature of an infection. So in other words, our immune system adapts to the presence of a bacterium or a virus. So it changes the way it works, and it behaves in a very specific manner to the pathogen. So that's what the adaptive immune system is all about. It's about adapting to specific organisms and making sure that we can defend ourselves properly against those.
And things like this are very much at the forefront of people's minds at the moment with COVID. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the story of the review that you made last May? Because there was a big update in autumn, and there have been lots of questions that have been thrown around about the role of vitamins in immunity. What's the story? What did you first discover in May that surprised you? And how has our understanding developed since then?
Yeah, so it's been known for a long time that many different lifestyle factors influence people's immune systems, and one of those is diet. So there's already a lot of information out there about aspects of diet, about specific nutrients, and the way they work to support the immune system in going about its business, so they support immune function. So there's plenty of literature there. So what I did back in spring, early summer of last year, was I gathered together the data that exists on specific micronutrients, that is vitamins and minerals, and their roles in supporting different aspects of both innate and adaptive immunity, just put together the idea that thinking about these micronutrients could be important in the context of what was then a new viral pandemic. Now, at the time I wrote the review, there was very little data actually on COVID-19 and nutrition.
It was really early days, wasn't it?
It was pretty early on. Actually, I think I wrote it about April time. So we didn't really know much about specific nutrients or nutrition in general in COVID-19. Of course, a lot of people did a lot of research over the course of the last 10 months or so. So now there are plenty of papers looking at the possibility that specific nutrients might play a role in helping our immune systems protect us against coronavirus, or maybe even can be useful in treating people once they are already infected. So the updates in these reviews are really trying to capture the emerging science specifically around particularly vitamins and minerals and COVID-19.
And what were the most important changes in our understanding, do you think?
So we already know, because scientists have been looking at this actually for decades, that some vitamins and, you know, vitamins A, C, D, and E, and also the B vitamins are important. And some minerals, particularly zinc, but also selenium, iron, copper, and one or two others, are important in supporting many components of the immune system, both the innate components and the adaptive components. So we knew all of that already, and we knew something about the importance of those nutrients in supporting antiviral defenses. So the research in the COVID era, if I can call it that, has really been measuring the levels of those nutrients in people's blood and relating that to whether they're infected or not and how severe the infections are. So these are what we call association studies, relating blood levels of nutrients with the presence or the severity of COVID-19. So there's plenty of studies now associating, for example, low vitamin D status, low zinc status, low selenium status with severity of COVID-19. I think this is really important research and important data, but we have to keep in mind these are what I am calling association studies, so simply relating low levels of those nutrients to the presence of more severe COVID-19. And really to prove that these nutrients are really vital, we need trials where we give people the nutrients and see what the effect is. And so far, we don't really have many of those sorts of studies in COVID-19. So we have progressed. We have progressed, but we haven't really got as far as we need to make really strong statements.
Yeah. So very recently, the BMJ said that there's insufficient evidence to support taking vitamin C solely to prevent or to treat COVID-19. But the NHS website says, I'm looking at it right this very second, actually, and we are in towards the end of February. And it says that if you're vulnerable, then you should be taking vitamin D supplements. There's been a lot of talk about vitamin D, a lot of it in the press. And I'm not sure if you feel that people have jumped on this as some sort of cure for COVID simply because science journalists are a little bit lazy. What's your view on the reporting about vitamin D?
Yeah, so what's clear is that there are plenty of these what I've called association studies between low vitamin D status and severity of COVID-19. I mean, there are probably 40, 50, maybe even more of these publications reporting this. So the association studies are actually pretty consistent. As I mentioned, what we don't have really are good trials where people have been given vitamin D in an effort to either prevent or treat COVID-19. Although there are a few studies where that has happened, and you know, there are some suggestions that might help. But I think the evidence is a bit slim right now. Mm. And we have to be careful not to let the enthusiasm overweigh the reality of the evidence. I mean, there's no doubt that all of these micronutrients I mentioned, all of these vitamins and minerals are essential for life and are important in supporting the immune system. But I wouldn't think that any one of them alone would be the magic bullet, for sure. But, you know, they will each play their individual role. And, you know, at this time, you know, small effects can be important in some people, I think.
And so is there any nutritional advice that consumers can take from this? Or does it just relate back to the idea of have a good varied diet, eat mainly fruit and veg and make it fresh and make it yourself if you can? Is there more, something more specific than that that we can give people?
Yeah, so I think you've summed it up pretty well. So the nutrients I'm talking about, obviously we get them in foods and we get them through a diverse and varied diet with lots of plant-based foods, so fruits, vegetables, seeds, nuts, pulses, and so on, berries, but also some animal foods, because some of the nutrients we're talking about, like vitamin D, for example, you know, the best source actually is oily fish, omega-3s, which are also important in the immune system. Again, oily fish is really important. Vitamin B12, you know, meat is the main source. So I think we need a blend of some animal-based foods along with a pretty strong plant-based diet. There remains the question about vitamin D, which you already asked. And, you know, the government does recommend that people use, let's call it a low-dose vitamin D supplement, because it's so hard to get enough vitamin D from our diets. Mm.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Philip Calder, Professor of Nutritional Immunology. Now, if you enjoyed this podcast, then you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from plant-based fish to ingredients trends. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Philip, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.